Good evening, and you're welcome to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM. You're warmly welcome as you join us on this Bank Holiday Sunday, the 6th of June. Father Jerry Kenny sitting in the chair this evening to present our programme of reflection, conversation and music over the next hour or so. Do stay with us. We hope that you're having a very enjoyable weekend, and if you're travelling, that you have a safe and comfortable journey. On our programme tonight, we'll be hearing from Father Peter McVerry, the housing campaigner, reflecting on his years of work. We will also be joined by Pádraig O'Toole, a theologian who has worked with the Corrymeela Centre in Northern Ireland on reconciliation. And in our interview, he reflects for us on the Book of Ruth in the Old Testament and what that can teach us about reconciliation and about living with difference. And of course, I will be joined by my colleague Stephen Fletcher for our conversation on happenings at the moment. So do stay tuned, but first we begin with some music. Here is Van Morrison. That was the voice of Van Morrison and Bright Side of the Road. You're tuned to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM on this Sunday, the 6th of June. I'm joined now by my colleague over in England, Stephen Fletcher. Stephen, a very good evening to you and welcome.
Good evening. Thank you, Jerry. Yeah, how appropriate. Last weekend was our bank holiday and we actually had some good weather, and the good weather continued for the early part of this last week. So we've been blessed with good weather for the first time for seems like a long time. But yeah, Bright Side of the Road, very appropriate choice, Jerry.
Well, last weekend was quite bright here as well. Unfortunately, during the week here, it got a little bit cloudy and rainy again. But, you know, we keep our hopes up. June is here, so let's hope that it will be true to its promise.
Yeah.
One of the things that has happened here over the past week has been the beginning of lifting of some restrictions for society. Especially this week, the hotels and the bed and breakfasts and that are opening again to accommodate people to stay, and a gradual reopening of other aspects of society as well in terms of sport and things like that. But we haven't, I think, yet made any great progress in lifting any further restrictions on church attendance. We're back to the 50 for normal church attendance, depending on the size. Larger churches can accommodate more. We're still at 50 restricted for weddings and for funerals and that. And we have no indication of when that number may increase, but hopefully over the next few weeks it will.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, here in the Midwest region as well, over the past week, the health authorities are sounding a word of caution because there was a spike in some of the positive testing that was done here over the past while. So they're just, you know, saying to us to be a little cautious around everything.
Yeah.
This virus hasn't gone away. We still need to keep up the myriad of controls that we have grown accustomed to around our interaction with others.
Yeah. And if you remember last time when we chatted, I had a certain optimism about me because I thought that we'd soon be back in Kilrush, but I fear that's not going to be the case. I'm afraid the rise in the Indian variant has caused problems. I know Ireland are very cautious about letting people back into the country, and certainly in England we're facing calls for further restrictions. But on the good news, for the first time since the pandemic, earlier in the week we had no deaths on one of the days, and we give thanks for that. And of course we do remember all those who have died, but there is signs that things are improving. But there's a lot of worry amongst the scientists, isn't there, about this Indian variant. And as we have said so often before, until we're all safe, none of us are safe. And I think, you know, that is a call to our governments to make the vaccines available across the world, not just look after our own.
It is. This is going to be an ongoing battle. And I think people are coming to accept that in some way or other, we're going to have to live with this COVID-19. Certainly into the near future anyway. Vaccinated or not, we still have to cope with it, and it's still going to be there, and we will still have to have some bit of restriction around our interaction.
Yeah. We had some exciting news, I suppose, depending on your politics in England, but our Prime Minister got married. I think one of the first Prime Ministers to get married whilst in office. He married his fiancée in Westminster Cathedral, the Catholic main church in London, and that caused a little bit of surprise. He's been divorced twice. He was baptised as a Catholic and then renounced that and became an Anglican when he was a boy at Eton, and he's now got married to his fiancée. I don't know. It's difficult to comment.
You're puzzled by it, and I suppose I am puzzled as well, because when I heard this news over the weekend, the penny hadn't dropped with me that actually the ceremony had been in Westminster Cathedral, which is the Catholic Cathedral of London. I just automatically presumed it was Westminster Abbey. But no, when I read into it in detail, and then I began to see that there was a lot of commentary around the fact, and I can understand that where people are coming from. And then the next thing to jump on, I suppose, is, oh well, this is the British Prime Minister, so the Catholic Church is doing a U-turn to accommodate the British Prime Minister. But that isn't at the kernel of this. In fact, you know, one of the commentaries, one of the best commentaries I've read about it from a theologian's point of view, is that Boris Johnson is being treated no differently from anybody who would have presented with his set of circumstances. According to the church law in relation to our sacraments, if Gerry Kenny was in a similar situation and presented for Catholic marriage, he would have been allowed to marry. It's really, I suppose, it's looking at it from another angle. But as our understanding of sacramental theology is that once a person is baptized, they cannot be refused entry into various aspects of faith unless there is something there that does prevent them.
Yeah.
And in Boris's situation, I suppose what would have prevented this was if he had entered a previous sacramental marriage in the eyes of the Catholic Church. But it is confusing. I can understand how confusing it is.
You know, I've seen, like you, I've read commentary on this because I was surprised to see it. And I understand that. So it's as if his previous marriages are not considered as valid by the Catholic Church. Fine. What concerns me is that there are a number of people who were married in a Catholic ceremony, and then they are the innocent party. Their partner has divorced them, and they cannot remarry in church. But equally, some of them are refused the sacrament because they've been divorced. You know, it just seems unfair to those who were married initially in the eyes of the church, who then may be an innocent party and have been divorced. And they've been refused. I'm thinking of one particular person who was actually, you know, refused the sacrament of Holy Communion in his church. And that seems very unfair.
Yeah, it is. There has been discussion in recent years. I know the German bishops have had a strong thinking in relation to all of that. And I think Pope Francis himself is open to looking at that, because I think as Father Peter Mac very later in our programme makes the point, what Pope Francis is trying to do with the church is that rather than looking at it through the lens of law and commands, that our church needs to move much more into the field of being pastorally responsive and showing the compassion of God for us on the journey. Now, it's a big change, if you like, and I think as we journey towards that, there will be these apparent contradictions and these hurts that people will present, and it's a difficult journey. And I suppose all we can do at the end of the day, which I think is at the kernel of what this particular marriage is sort of saying, is like this. None of us have the right to say that the grace of God is not active in a person's life, regardless of their circumstance. And I suppose the Catholic Church, if you look at it from the point of view, the Catholic Church didn't have the right to refuse the request of Boris to be married in the Catholic Church. When it investigated, it had no right to refuse him that opportunity.
Yeah, I fully accept that. And I'm always very wary about commenting on other people's churches. It's a case of not throwing stones.
But the circumstance that you mentioned too, Stephen, is very valid, and I know I have come across it myself, and it is quite painful for people to realise like that they cannot, if, as you say, they're the innocent party. There is a procedure within our church for trying to rectify that, but it is a procedure that takes a bit of time. It's called an annulment procedure, whereby when the church investigates and sees that there is a valid reason as to why this marriage did not in the first instance fulfill the criteria for it to be a sacramental marriage. And then the person is free to be married again, if you like, in our church. But that is a complicated process. It's just that is the way things are. But there's been a lot of discussion around that. And hopefully, I think Pope Francis is trying to make it a little bit more pastoral orientated rather than legalistic to meet people's circumstances as they're presenting. Well, Stephen, look, it's been great to chat to you. We'll continue the chat maybe next week and hopefully have more news on developments in relation to the easing of restrictions and that as we move along in through this month.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's great to be in the month of June, and my next piece of music that I've chosen is a favourite of mine coming from one of my favourite shows, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel. So let's celebrate the fact that we're in June, and here is June is bursting out all over.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Jerry. Cheerio.
March went out like a lion, a whipping up the water in the bay. Then April cried and stepped aside, and along come pretty little May. May was full of promises, but she didn't keep them quick enough for some. And a crowd of doubting Thomases was predicting that the summer'd never come.
But it's coming, by gum, you can feel it come. You can feel it in your heart, you can see it in the ground.
You can hear it in the trees, you can smell it in the breeze.
Look around, look around, look around.
June is busting out all over the meadow and the hill. Buds are busting out of bushes, and the romping river pushes every little wheel that wheels beside a mill. June is busting out all over. The feeling is getting so intense that the young Virginia creepers have been hugging the bejeepers out of all the morning glories on the fence. Because it's June,
June, June, June.
Just because it's June.
Busting out with sap.
Love has found my bride in June.
my sister's even loonier,
and my ma's getting kittenish with pap.
Julie's busting out all over.
Two ladies, the men are paying court. Lots of ships are kept at anchor just because a captain's hanker
for a comfort they can only get in port.
Because it's June,
because it's June, 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 just because it's June.
Busting Out All Over, sung there for us by Renee Fleming and the cast of the Broadway production of Carousel from 2018. And on this June bank holiday Sunday evening, you're tuned now to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM. A Dose of Reality is the title of a book published by Redemptorist Communications in 2019. It contains a number of the collected articles that were published in the Redemptorist magazine Reality over the years and written by Father Peter McVerry, the social justice campaigner. In our following interview, Father McVerry reflects with Pat Coyle on that journey over those years as he campaigned and on the present situation of homelessness and how it might be tackled. He also talks about the change that has happened in the church and how we might respond to the people of God in our time.
Well, it's a reflection over many years of my experiences, not just with homeless people, but with what's happening in Irish society. And I'd be very critical of what's happening in Irish society. We have massive levels of homelessness, rents that people can't afford, houses that people can't afford. So we have huge crises within our society, and I'm reflecting on that. The editor many years ago of Reality Magazine asked me to do a few articles, and I did 12 articles for him for a year. And then I said, well, now I'm finished. And he said, we'll just do one or two more. So I think I'm on my 223rd article for Reality Magazine. And so when the current editor suggested maybe we'd put some of them into a book, I went through them. Many of them are out of date, in other words. If you're talking about homelessness 3 years ago, it's pretty out of date. But we picked out 30 of what I thought were the most significant articles and that were relevant, both when I wrote them and also again today. So it's looking at Irish society and also looking at the church through perhaps different eyes to the way we normally use.
I mean, massive changes have taken place in the time since you started writing, both within the institutional church and within society. I mean, broad brushstrokes here, but has it got worse?
In some ways, things have got much, much worse. When we started, obviously, the poverty levels and the housing was far worse than it is now. But nevertheless, in those days, back in the 60s, the 70s, almost anybody could own their own house. If you had an average salary, a guard there or a teacher or a nurse, you could get a mortgage. And if you didn't have the average salary, you could go on a council waiting list for a couple of years. You were given a council house. And if you wanted to, you could purchase that house from the council. So almost everybody could aspire to owning their own house. Now, today, things are so much different. Many people are homeless, excluded from any sort of housing. There are tens of thousands of people renting who are simply struggling to pay the rent. In fact, 5% of those who are renting today are paying 75% of their income to the landlord. And I mean, I just find that horrific, that you can rent all your, you can work all months, get a salary at the end, you hand over 75% straight away to a landlord. People who are unable to work. One of the articles is about a woman who studied hard in school, went to college, got a very good degree, got a good job, but now can't afford to live because of the cost of renting. And so she is on the poverty line, even though she has a good job. So in some respects, things have got much, much worse. So something has gone wrong, and it's really the economic system that we're embedded in. I think that economic system focuses purely on aggravating rent, aggravating wealth, accumulating wealth with very little or inadequate consideration given to how we spread that wealth around. So in many ways, I think we are in a worse. Less people in poverty, but if you're in poverty, you're more fixed in your poverty. It's much harder to get out of today. Back in those days, a young kid, 16 years of age, we could go onto a building site and ask them, look, I'll make the tea for you. And they'd say, OK, and then maybe he could work his way up. Today, you can't even go on a building site without a safe pass, which is going to cost you €100, a manual handling certificate, which is going to cost you €40, steel cap boots, which is going to cost you another €50, a high-vis vest, going to cost you another €10. You can't even go onto a site to look for work without spending €200, which most of those young people just don't have. So people are more stuck in their poverty today, even though there are less people in poverty.
What is missing? Like, what is it with our politicians? They don't see this. And what is it that they don't see?
I think the system is geared to those who have wealth. They are the ones who are benefiting massively now from the wealth that is being created. The government are on the side of the banks. They're on the side of the big international investment funds who have come in, and purely for financial reasons. But they are either displacing low-income families or making it impossible for them to actually access housing. And they're on the side of landlords. And indeed, many landlords are struggling financially if they bought during the Celtic Tiger years. But there are many rogue landlords out there who are extremely greedy, who just simply want more and more money and don't care what happens to their tenants if they evict them. So I think we need a government that's going to focus on those who are marginalised, those who are poor, those who are powerless. The ultimate inequality in our society is powerlessness. You know, if you're not able to pay your mortgage, you're in a confrontation with the banks. Banks have all the power. You have no power whatsoever. If you're unable to pay your rent, or the rent goes up, or the property you're in is of appalling condition, you have no power. The landlord has all the power. People won't complain about the condition of their rented flat because they're afraid they're going to be kicked out. And if your mortgage has been sold to the international investment funds, you just have no power. So the basic inequality is an inequality of power, and the government should be readdressing that inequality just as much as readdressing the inequality of income and wealth.
You mentioned the church as well. Has over the years, you will have seen the changes, the child sexual abuse scandals, the impact of that cannot be underestimated on ordinary people who believed. But also with the rise of secularism, it's seemingly out of touch maybe sometimes with the zeitgeist and with where people are. The gay referendum particularly showed the church way off beam, really. What's your reflections on that in the book and over the years?
I think the church has been too focused on the church's problems. It has been not enough on society's problems. If the church continues to, if the church focuses too much on the issues that affect the church, people just simply walk away and say, I'm not interested. I believe that the church's role is to proclaim a God for whom every single human being is a child of God and has the dignity of being a child of God. So I believe the church's role is to affirm the dignity of every human being. And when you have travellers living on the side of the road, when you have people who are homeless and children living in hotels, that is a sheer denial of the dignity of people. And I think the church should be screaming from the rooftops about this in the lack of dignity that we are giving to people. So I feel unless the church rediscovers the centrality of social justice to its mission, I think people are going to continue to hemorrhage away. Young people today have a great sense of fairness and a great sense of justice. Show them that that is at the heart of the Christian message. Love one another as I have loved you is Jesus' commandment. And they're doing that in so many different ways. And what we are trying to do as church, I think, is trying to get them back into Mass. And that's never going to work. I think we should be encouraging them in the pursuit of justice and showing them and celebrating with them the fact that this is at the heart of the Christian message.
Does Pope Francis give you hope? Because when you would have been writing those articles, he, for the most part, he wouldn't have been a Pope until the last number of years. But he does seem to be pointing a way that is very different from what has gone before.
Yeah, I am very encouraged by Pope Francis. Prior to that, the church is very focused on laws and laying down laws and saying that your relationship with God depended on how you observed those laws. Now, Pope Francis is moving us towards a different image of God, a God who cares, a God of compassion. And that's the God that Jesus revealed. Jesus lived amongst the poor. He ate with those who were excluded and marginalized and unwanted in his society. He healed the sick who were sidelined in society. So I think he's bringing us back to the God that Jesus revealed in the Gospels, the God of compassion. And he's meeting a lot of opposition within the church for that. Those who insist that God laid down these laws and what's important to God is we obey those laws. And of course, there is a place for laws, but not the place that we gave it in the past. So I'm very encouraged by Pope Francis. I think the God of compassion is the only God that people are going to come to listen to, the only God that people want to know about. They're not interested in knowing about a God who lays down laws.
And finally, Peter, you've written those 30 articles. You know, they're the ones that are most relevant. Things are worse in ways, as you've said. What gives you hope and what keeps you going? Are you still hopeful?
I'm still hopeful, but it's a long-term hope. I mean, when I started, the problem we dealt with was homeless children who had left their family home because of violence or abuse. And then nobody wanted to know. Nobody in authority wanted to know. When we opened our first hostel, I was told, we don't agree with this. We don't see the point of this. We are not going to support this. Today, things for homeless children who have left their home are infinitely better. Not perfect, but hugely better. And it's that sort of time frame that that I look to. I would be hoping that maybe in 10 or 15 years' time, we would look back and say, you left people sleeping on the street? How could you possibly have done that? That's absolutely outrageous. So I would hope that we would move towards a situation where we respect the dignity and make that dignity a reality in the lives of people.
Well, we wish you all the best with your work and also with your book, which is Peter McVerry, A Dose of Reality, published by the Redemptorists. Do you know the cost?
I think it's a tenner, as far as I know.
And flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, but still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Dancing way that you feel as every fairy tale comes real. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go, and if you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love at all. Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now, oh friends, they're acting strange. They shake their heads and they say that I've changed. But something's lost and something's gained.
in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. I really don't.
The voice there of Ronan Keating and Both Sides Now. You tune to Beyond Belief here on Clare FM on this Sunday evening. Porrigo Tuama is a poet, theologian, broadcaster and former leader of the Corrymeela Community for Peace and Reconciliation in Belfast. In our next interview, Porrig discusses with Pat Coyle of the Irish Jesuit Communications a fascinating story of the process workshop he developed with his late close friend Glenn Jordan, who was also a theologian and a former member of Corrymeela. Concerned about the divisive and coarsened discourse that happened over the Brexit referendum, Glenn and Pori decided to examine the whole issue of borders and belonging using the Old Testament story of Ruth as a focal point. Pori begins by telling us about the Book of Ruth and what it contains.
The Book of Ruth is an extraordinary short drama that you find in the Hebrew Bible. It's in four acts and it's written with a real artistry of drama. In the first act, we're introduced to the characters, really. There's a famine in Bethlehem and a family of mother, father and two sons leave and go to enemy territory nearby, but enemy nonetheless to Moabite territory. The father dies and the two sons marry local girls. And that's grand for 10 years. But then the two sons die of a famine that's come there. And so you have this trinity of widows left behind: Naomi, the mother, and her two Moabite daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. And Naomi decides she's going to go back to her home, to Bethlehem, and she would not receive a great welcome there, which she knew she wouldn't. And Ruth says, "Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God." I always get the impression that Naomi might have not have wanted of that. I don't think Naomi wanted to live. She was a husk of a husk, it's described. Anyway, they go back. Naomi, who now is calling herself Mara, meaning bitter, and her Moabite from Moab daughter-in-law, who keeps on being called the Moabite from Moab. Chapter 2 then is about Ruth from Moab be able to access social welfare? Will the marriage that she had to Naomi's son be considered valid, because marriages between Israelites and Moabites were not considered to be valid? And really it's a question about, will she have the legal access to social welfare that she should have been granted as a right? And what ways is her life and body in danger as she goes to access social welfare? Chapter 3 really is about her and Naomi having realized there was an opportunity for Ruth to make a fortuitous marriage and putting some plots in place to make that marriage happen. And chapter 4 is about this man, Boaz, who she wants to get married to, but he's not the closest relative. It should have been someone else. And it's him kind of engaging in a little bit of legal manipulation, which plays on the prejudices towards Moabites in order for him to marry Ruth. Over and over again, you see that the law is changed in the face of an experience of an individual displaced, widowed, border-crossing Moabite woman. And that you see that the text, it's like an extended parable, really, is a meditation on how, in the face of a seemingly fixed law, that law can change in light of an experience of having somebody in front of you who is demonstrating loving kindness, and where loving kindness is the true interpretive lens of a law.
So that's the story of Ruth. And then you took that story along with Glenn Jordan, a friend and dear colleague of yours. You used it in the Brexit context. Tell me about that.
Well, in 2015, I was leading Corrymeela And the precursor to Brexit was happening. Nigel Farage from UKIP was making lots of noise. David Cameron was going back and forth. Questions about what a referendum would be were up there. It was clear that, you know, Britain as an extraordinary parliamentary democracy was going to use a referendum, which is usually used in a constitutional democracy. And that seemed to be bewildering because there was no legal mandate for any kind of information or facts. And this thing about what is Ireland, what is the UK, what is Britain, what is Irishness, what is Britishness, all of those things are up in the air. It was as obvious as the nose in your face to anybody in the North that questions about the North and the border were not going to be considered when it came to the big English questions about Brexit. And Brexit, in my opinion, I know Glenn shared this too, was primarily an English question, not a British one, but an English one. And the people of England are great and they have serious questions that they want to ask. But I would have rathered it be an English national question rather than something that incorporated the question about the border, the British border in Ireland. And so Glenn and I were talking and I said, look, what we really need is a story, a safe story, like a parable, like a drama that evokes questions of borders, questions of law, questions of religion, and holds an identity and holds those in a, I suppose, a moral light for people to listen to. And I was saying, I think the Book of Ruth would be perfect. It's not an annoying book. There's no resurrections. There's no miracles. You're brought into the landscape of the story very quickly and very easily. It's like a piece of Shakespeare, really. Nobody knows who wrote it either, which is, so it comes from this imagination. It's quite brilliant. And one of the things it does is it highlights that there are two territories, Israelite territory and Moabite territory, between whom there's enmity, long-standing enmity. And the things people say about each other there go way into the past and people have conflict about what the conflict was about. And so we thought this is the perfect way to talk about Irishness and Britishness, as well as Englishness and Scottishness and, you know, anxieties between Devon and Cornwall, anxieties between different jurisdictions of Ireland, anxieties within those jurisdictions also, you know, the Dubliners and the rest of the Culchies, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm from the People's Republic of Cork. So, of course, you know, Cork and not Cork, as there is. And you see ways within which sometimes for fun and other times with deadly impact, the tyranny of small differences that can happen in localities can be really serious and have to be taken very seriously. And we would probably have gotten caught up in what the proper version of the story was if we tried to take local narratives. Taking the Hebrew Book of Ruth felt like a perfect example. We would explore, here's how the Bible shows resentment toward the Moabites. Do you think the Moabites told the story in the same way? What are the resentments you have against people from Scotland or England or Wales or the Republic or the North or the city or the countryside? What are the things your family held against each other?
Yeah, because what happened was you and Glenn wrote different chapters on the book and then you took the show on tour, really. Isn't that right?
It's more that we wrote some resources. There was 8 resources that were just 2 pages each. And then we took the show on the road. So over the course of about 3 years, we met with 5,000 people in parish groups all across Ireland. Some of it was translated into Welsh. I was across doing loads of work in England and Scotland. And in civic halls, parish halls, festivals, political conversations, everywhere, we met with 5,000 people. Corrymeela is part funded by the Fund for Reconciliation from the Dublin government. And so we went to them to say, look, they were doing great community engagement. And some of that in community engagement did engage religious leaders, north and south. But there was nothing specifically catering to the religious community. And we were saying, look, if nothing else, if nothing other than population, those who attend a monthly religious service are the biggest club in Ireland, north and south. So we proposed to them that we'd do this and we proposed a certain amount that they'd fund, just a stipendary amount, really. And they doubled it. They said, this is great. Thank you. And then the Community Relations Council in the North, as well as an American fund, the Henry Luce Foundation, gave some money. And then we took that show on the road. And basically, Glenn and I took pages and books, really, of notes from the community conversations we'd had. You know, we'd ask people, what did you learn about the other when you were growing up, about whether the other was Ireland or England or the Brits or whatever, you know, the North, Catholics, Protestants, Nationalists, Unionists, whatever. And we'd ask people to talk about those things and say what the Book of Ruth asks us to do is to consider what might be a benevolent story that could save us. And this was not an exercise in let's play nice with each other. This was an exercise in saying, what are the ways within which our ways of telling each other's stories has deeply wounded us? What are the ways within which negotiations about a trade deal are inevitably going to fail us if we think that is the culmination of British-Irish relations for 2020 or 2019 or whatever? How can we tell stories that are true, filled with pain, but also filled with possibility in the question of British-Irish relationships?
Yeah, I was thinking you put a lot of faith in the story. The story of Ruth is a powerful story, but one of the problems in this whole Brexit thing are the narratives that came out that were not helpful. You know, a narrative of maybe a narrow nationalism of a little Britain that never was and was really powerful because it encaptured, you know, longing for a past going back there. How did you negotiate that?
Well, I like the way you say it. You know, these days you hear marketing is all about story. You know, I bought a watch a couple of years ago and the fella, it was a Swatch watch, and the fella in the Swatch watch shop said to me, do you want to come to a Swatch watch party tomorrow? I was like, no. And then I was curious. I went, why? And he went, everybody there would be wearing Swatch watches. And it wasn't that we would only be wearing a Swatch watch. We'd be wearing clothes and Swatch watches. And then he said, and we can all tell our Swatch watch story. And I was like, under no circumstances. Like, that party doesn't interest me at all. And I'm a man who likes a party. But you see the way within which, and you can see the way a shallow reading of story is just being used for capitalist purposes there. It can be used for manipulative purposes. In the story of Brexit, you can see a version of the past of Britain being told. The majority of people who are proclaiming the past of Britain would have been poor and despised their government in that past that's being spoken of, you know. You can see the same in Ireland, you know. I hear people telling the story of Ireland and the visit of Frederick Douglass to Ireland in 1845, him saying, this is the magnificent visit, I've been treated with such esteem, you know, my despised race in America is not despised here. That's a version of the past. And while that's true, Frederick Douglass's words in 1853, where he said the Irish American, this is the 8 years after the start of the famine, he said the Irish American has taken on our avocation, meaning the Black American. And he's saying the Irish American is immediately upon landing, taking on a whiteness that was, you know, continuing on the very racism that Frederick Douglass had been advocating against in terms of advocating for emancipation. And so there's all kinds of ways within which the story we tell about the past can be used for manipulative purposes. And that's why we thought that the Book of Ruth is a fascinating one, because the Book of Ruth is an intervention. It is an intervention into a story of Israelite Moabite tension that was really like cancer, never going to die. It's just going to continue and to continue and to continue. And somebody decided what we need is a narrative that embodies in the story of two women, a story of the Israelite territory and the story of the Moabite territory. Naomi and Ruth really are narrative embodiments of national identities. But both of them have been grieved. Both of them have known great pain, both of them have known great hunger, and both of them are looking for safety and survival. And both of them are saying the law and the way we speak about each other needs to change if mutual survival can be possible. And in that way, it is a profoundly moral intervention into a story about how populations tell stories about our nearest enemies.
That was Porrigo Tuama, poet and theologian, discussing with Pat Coyle a recent book that he has published called Borders and Belonging, The Book of Ruth, A Story for Our Times. Further information on this book and on that work can be had at the Irish Jesuits website page. And here from The Book of Ruth is The Song of Ruth.
Your people.
Today, throughout the world in the Catholic calendar, we celebrate the feast of the body and blood of Jesus Christ, a reminder to us of the great gift of the Eucharist to nourish us. Sister Anne Crowley now leads us in a reflection for this feast.
Relax in my real presence. Come to me for refreshment. I am both with you and within you. Rest in my loving presence. I will bless and restore you. I will meet you in the stillness of this sacred host. I am in constant communion with you. One bread, one body, risen, living, body of Christ. Corpus Christi, Christ's broken bread and outpoured wine. Bread for the broken, wine for the wounded. The body and blood of Christ, here in God's kingdom, given to us as food. A living sign of God in Christ. God nourishing his people, building up Christ's body. Let us celebrate this blessed sacrament, the real presence of Christ, the Eucharist, fullness of life, eternal salvation, God hidden in a host, physical body, mystical body, sacramental body, sacrament most holy. We are Christ's body now, bread broken for others. Our love is his outpoured wine. We are the bread for our world. We are the leaven. We are the wheat for others. Nurturing good, bringing to birth, sharing faith. Many hearts are hungry. Many live in darkness. Many thirst for justice. Many are far from home. Let us break the bread until all are healed by the real presence. Sacrament most holy, all praise and thanks to you. Corpus Christi.
Christ, and as he lay sons of the earth.
How beautiful, how beautiful, how beautiful is the body of Christ.
Well, we're coming close to the end of our programme for this Bank Holiday Sunday here on Clare FM. Thank you for your company, and we leave you with the reminder that we will be with you again next Sunday night at 9 o'clock for Beyond Belief, and also earlier on next Sunday morning for the celebration of Mass here on Clare FM. Our thanks to our guests, to Father Peter McVerry and to Pori Gotuma, for chatting with us here on the programme this evening, and to Pat Coyle and all in the Irish Jesuits for their cooperation with those interviews. My thanks to Stephen Fletcher, our colleague here, for our chat earlier, and also for producing our programmes here for Beyond Belief. Wherever you are on this Sunday evening, I wish you safety and warmth. May God's blessing be with you in the week ahead. Slán agus beannacht.